Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. And it's that time again as we record here on Thursday morning, a little earlier than normal. Maybe we'll get it out a little earlier than normal.
Maybe.
We just released the October 2025 UT Texas Politics Project poll, which was chock full of results. There's a lot in this poll moving in several directions. I think there's some underlying dimensionality here. Darren has a theme. Now, as is customary, as you can hear in the background, I'm very happy to be joined today by my friends, colleagues, and collaborators, Professor Darren Shaw. Darren, welcome.
Great to be here, as always.
You're in a pretty good mood, given the situation of the Dodgers.
My boys are fading fast, but that's okay.
I guess that's
money. We're talking about politics.
I don't know if that's money well spent.
Yeah, come over here where it's safe and warm.
And Josh Blank, how are we doing this morning, Josh? You survived all the heavy lifting from the poll. You seem alert and active.
Yeah, well, you know, it was an interesting survey. I mean, look, you know, a lot going on, but obviously if you study public opinion, a lot to ask about.
Yeah, so, and you know, we got
a lot of interesting stuff.
We got a lot of kids to keep track of now.
A lot of kids to keep track of.
So, Josh, you survived all the lifting for the poll at the same time, just to not be cryptic as we're, you know, continuing to do the first voyage of our Government 310 online course, which Darren's going to snicker at us out about right now, probably.
Good luck.
So we're lucky to have you to get through all the data, to get everything ready to release.
It's a nice respite.
Load it into the website, and, you know, so appreciate that.
Yeah, no,
public kudo on that. Okay, order of operations. So, you know, to jump in it, we want to talk about what the poll tells us about the context of, I think, the early stages of the 2026 election. I find myself, you know, after months of going, it's still early, kind of going, okay, it's not as early as it was, kind of, and we can unpack that a little bit. And then maybe move into what we found out about the candidates and what it tells us about the early stages of the election and some of the, you know, really, I think we'll focus mostly on the Senate race, frankly, given where we are, but we'll see where we go. So, Josh, why don't you start us off as usual? Give us the disclosure on the poll, what we're talking about here.
Sure. So the poll, you know, as is the standard practice, we surveyed 1,200 self-declared registered voters in Texas, and the poll was in the field between October 10th and the 20th of 2025, of course. So the margin of error for the full sample is plus or minus 2.83 percentage points, and there are larger margins of error for subgroups, so smaller parts of the sample. And that's the basic, I think, what we need to know here, right?
Yeah, and I think it all went
It all went smoothly. I'll just say, you know, all of this is available on the website. So if you want to read the full methodology statement, really dig into it, you know, and also download every piece of it. We have it up there. So if there's more, questions on methods,
please. As always, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. You know, hundreds of graphics from this poll alone.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, archival results of every poll we've done. And now, you know, I always bring this up and my count is always a little, but I believe this is 70.
I think
this is poll 70 if you count everything in the archive, but
wow. Yeah, right. I mean, it's pretty close. If it's not 70, it's like just over 70 under.
It's there you go.
Well,
just take a pause and pat yourself on the back there.
No, and we talk about it every once in a while, but you know, we'll see, but we're a stone, you know, I mean, you especially, you know, you're a stone's throw from 20 years of this field of the survey, you know, which is like, it's going to be here pretty quick.
Of course, in an environment where there's a lot of stones being
thrown.
Well,
that's why I said, I said that with very, we'll see.
All right. Before we get into that, I feel like I'm going to have to decline an interview with a student journalist. We're not going to talk about that. So Darren, let's get to the context here. You know, in the rollout materials, interesting continuity here. We led somewhat with the economy. You know, we've been tracking that, I think, in some detail for a while. It's looking, you know, the data is emerging in a very interesting way. So before we talk about the candidates, I'm wondering what you think about the environment, because I find the economic numbers really fascinating in terms of you know, how mediocre at best they are. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, I mean, I think that's pretty clear, but I'm also wondering, you know, I want to arrive at, you know, how much that matters now, how you plug that into the evolving election environment.
Well, we were having a brief conversation before we started the podcast today, and I offered that the one word that strikes me viewing all of the data here in the poll this month is malaise. To hearken back to you know, listeners who remember the famous Jimmy Carter speech in which he didn't actually use the word malaise, but it was implied.
Yeah.
And, you know, essentially blamed the American people softly for not having confidence and not, you know, believing in themselves.
Buck up, campers.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a pep talk, but it came across as a little bit of a scolding.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, having learned the lesson of Jimmy Carter, would prefer not to scold Texans.
Yes.
I think
I'm already writing like the, I mean, if we were doing TikTok things, this would be the, Dr. Shah uses the M word.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess the reason that I have that sense is that, you know, if you look at the overall numbers and we ask a question consistently about how people rate the state of the economy compared to a year ago, better off, worse off, about the same. And those numbers essentially collapsed in the fall of 2021. And that was the point at which Biden really began to sink, that his ratings began to sink. He never really recovered. Those numbers on the economy bumped around a little bit. But, you know, just to put a point on it, we had an October 21 survey in which the total percentage of people who said the economy is better off than a year ago, 24%. Worse off 55. You compare that to right now, October of 2025, you know, 4 years later, better 27%, worse 53.
Yeah.
You know, and so those numbers are right on top. And I would also point out, and I want Josh to kind of chime in on this too, but Donald Trump's approval ratings on the economy in October of 2020, after COVID had happened and the economy had taken this big hit, total approved 52, total disapproved 42. Which we've talked about before, that sort of kind of optimistic view of Trump's handling of the economy. It was there at the time, and it was recalled by people heading into the 2024 election. Today, 36% approve of his handling of the economy, 52% disapprove. So he has, you know—
That's a bummer.
His ratings are significantly worse now than they were, you know, kind of during the nadir of the COVID hit on the economy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what I love making comparisons. So it's interesting looking at these national numbers and having such a long trend line because I think, you know, as we are
the numbers on the national economy.
That's where I'm focused on national economy. Yeah. And so here we are a year out, and I think, you know, one of the things I feel like I've internalized as a sort of observer of public opinion and a pollster is like when people tell you the economy's bad, you should listen to them. And it's very common for people to kind of come up with like, well, no, it's just these people, or it's just partisanship or whatever. But I mean, when I go back and say, well, look, you know, why are we focusing on the economy? So right now, as you said, 53% say the economy is worse off. If we go back to October 2017 polling, so we're looking at the same poll in Trump's first term in the midterm, which was, you know, was then followed by the 2018 elections, in which Democrats had a pretty big year, right? The economy at that point nationally, 43% said the economy was better off than a year ago. 33% said it was the same. 22% said it was worse. So 22% saying it was worse is more than doubled at this point to 53% today. But we can go back even further. That's the thing about this time series. We can go all the way back to 2010 in October before the Tea Party wave came. And a lot of people were just saying, oh, this is just sour grapes. Republicans are just saying the economy's bad because they're mad at Obama. And then we see this wave. And what was it then? It was 52-24. And we're at 53-27 right now in terms of worse, better.
Yeah.
So this is like a big story, kind of like hiding in plain sight in some ways. And maybe not. And I mean, I'll say we always have this thing like maybe none of it matters. Like maybe partisanship is so strong or negative partisanship is so strong. But looking at these numbers a year out and comparing them to previous elections where we've seen like pretty seismic activity, it looks pretty comparable.
Yeah. I think the political implications of this, you know, we've talked about how partisans essentially rationalize their views on the state of the economy. But that's only true to an extent.
Yeah.
Right? Biden's numbers were awful. And, you know, yes, largely Democrats voted for the Harris, you know, Walz ticket in spite of those numbers. But they didn't say the economy was great.
Yeah.
It was a headwind for them.
Right. Exactly. And
clearly.
And you look at the groups where Trump has and the Republican Party have made gains since 2016. Latinos, younger voters, especially younger men, blue-collar whites. I find it hard to believe that these voters aren't going to, you know, be affected by the perception that, you know, he hasn't turned the economy around. And he's got time. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's some reasons to believe the economy is going to be different, better or worse, a year from now. But, you know, we're eight months in at this point, yeah, nine months in.
Well,
and
the future projections. Well, so,
yeah,
that's
exactly. That's the challenge, right, is that right now, you know, the plurality of Texans, 44%, say they expect the economy to be worse off in a year. And this is just a consistent trend. If we go back to the end of last year, it was 23% said the economy is going to be worse off in a year. In February, 31%, then 35%, then 38%, then 40%, now 44%.
Right.
And the share saying it's going to be better keeps going down basically in exchange.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, that's the, I mean, you know, we sort of talk about this like in the class and stuff, and it's like, it's kind of like, why do people, you know, why is the economy so important? It's like, because you can't lie to people about what they're experiencing when they pay for things, when they get their paycheck. And you try.
People try.
And you try. Right. But also when people are mad about the economy, or they think that things aren't going well, they look to make a change of some kind or another. And that's why you look at these numbers and think, this is not, you know, I mean, you said, can you turn it around in this time period in terms of the economy piece of it?
Part of the problem is, you know, as we all often have to remind ourselves and about the voters is, you know, voters ascribe a lot more control to the president on, you know, can he turn it around? Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's only so much within his power short of just.
Right, and these things are not
massive physical stimulus or something, which is obviously not on the board.
Well, and these things are not independent of each other.
Right.
Like lagging consumer confidence affects business decisions, and business decisions affect the economy, and so you get this cycle that's going on right now. I mean, ask anybody who studies the economy more deeply than the three of us do, and they'll tell you that a lot of business is sort of frozen right now. They don't know the effect of AI, the effect of tariffs. You know, and if they're not willing to commit resources to doing the kind of things that are necessary to boost the economy, you're not going to get much. And absent consumer sentiment that supports those sorts of investments, you're kind of in this odd stalemate right now.
Well, there's an interesting disjuncture between how the administration is using their political influence over businesses to kind of, browbeat people over not passing on price increases. And I think one of the effects of that was it delayed the implementation of some of those price increases due to tariffs. And so now there's still that unknown variable. I mean, Walmart waited months before they just sort of quietly said, we're going to have to raise prices now.
Yeah.
And I think that there's areas of that going on in the economy. I want to move on to Trump, but before we move on, because we're talking about this notion, and I think it's come up in the past, but I think it's worth hitting it again. It does seem to me that when you look at these numbers and, you know, we talk almost every poll or every other poll since there's all this economic turmoil about the interaction of party identification and, motivated reasoning and reporting on the economy. But it does seem to me that the way we have this set up with what you see in the national economic evaluations, then the state evaluations, then the personal evaluations does give us and you guys, particularly you, Darren, would know more about the research on this than I do. But it does seem to me like that the less you get away from these big macro level, more abstract evaluations of the national economy that are seem to be bound to be more tied up in partisanship. But when you look at the personal economic numbers, you know, it seems to me the party influence changes. And particularly in this environment where you have one party kind of owning everything, you know, the Republican reporting on their personal economic situation from a year ago, I think, is about 20 points lower than their estimation of the national economy.
Yeah, I think that's right. So 36% of Republicans say that their personal economic situation is better. You know, this is one of the things, and I mean, I'll just like—
And the national in the, is—
Oh, and the national—
I think it's in the 70s.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Right, that's where
About 60s or 70s.
It's 20, give or take, I think.
Yeah, that's right. You know, this is one of those things I think is always a little bit— I mean, it's the nature of, just how the sausage gets made for a second. One of the, problems with having a trend question is that sometimes you're like, well, it's a little confusing. We've got to think about this, right? And one of the things I'd point out in that number is the plurality of Republicans, 40% say that things are the same compared to a year ago. So where were we a year ago?
Yeah.
A year ago, Republicans were saying the economy was trash. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? I mean, like, it was the worst. I mean, Donald Trump was saying it was the worst economy in the history of the face of known record keeping and economic numbers and all these other things. And that was reflected in the numbers. So if there's any, like, veracity to that, and Republicans did express really negative attitudes toward, in fact, more negative attitudes towards the state economy and their personal economic situation during that time period. So when they say, yeah, about the same, you got to think, well, what does that mean? What is the point of reference if it's actually a year ago? Because a year ago, they were saying it was pretty bad.
Yeah, I would build on that point by looking at a battery of questions we ran here. I think if you're following along at home, it'd be Q16.
Right.
And we really enjoy kind of drilling down into economic perceptions, right? It's one thing to say, well, the economy's no good. But when you ask people what they're concerned about, and this gets to the excellent point Josh made a few minutes ago about, you know, when you're telling people that they're wrong about what they feel, you probably ought to take a step back and ask yourself if you really want to
die on that hill. Good general advice, relationship advice.
And the variation you see in levels of concern expressed about specific aspects of the economy, I think is really fascinating, right? So at the high end, you got about 2/3 of Texans saying that they're very concerned about the price of consumer and goods and food. Same about the cost of health care. This, by the way, is an aspect of this we can talk about. I think we didn't focus a lot on the government shutdown, but one of the sneaky positive, and I say this in purely political terms, positive aspects about the shutdown from a Democratic perspective is raise the salience of healthcare as an issue. I think there's a lot wrong with what the Democrats have done, both substantively and messaging with respect to the government shutdown. But, you know, however we want to slice and dice that, healthcare is on the table, and I think that always redounds to the Democrats' benefit.
I think, and I'd have to go back and look a little bit, but my impression also was that they had kind of jumped on that wave a little bit, that there had been upticking in assailants on healthcare for a little while now.
Yeah, we've been talking in here a lot, and I've been saying, and, you know, I mean, not that I wanted, you know, whatever, saying in talks and stuff that for a while now that healthcare is kind of bubbling under.
Yeah, and
it's always kind of percolating, and particularly among Democrats, but
when we were talking
about, it's not irrelevant to Republicans.
Right. When we were talking about prices and cost of living and stuff like this, there's kind of an assumption that when Biden was president, that issue just inherently helped Republicans. And we saw data early on that said, well, it kind of depends on what aspect of prices you're talking about, because the parties have different credibility on handling prices of different issues domains. But those are at the high end. You still got price of goods and food and healthcare. Then you get this sort of other tranche, you know, in the sort of 40s to 50s in terms of people saying they're very concerned about it. And it's basically can't find jobs, national debt, tariff policy, budget deficit, like not at the top, but in this kind of middle range.
And jobs moved up this time.
Yeah. Right. And then at the bottom end, you've got stock market and stability of banks and financial institutions in the 20s or in the high teens. So that variance is interesting, I think. And honestly, I don't know that you could look at that and not say, that sounds about right. I mean, if you're actually taking an economic analysis of where the economy is weakest.
Right.
And what we tend to say is, you know, these results all hang together, right? Because we see the cost of healthcare and the price of food and consumer goods at the top of that list. And what we see at the bottom of Trump's job approval ratings in the issue specific areas is healthcare, his handling of healthcare. And then in terms of the highest levels of disapproval, it is around the economy. It's around inflation and prices. And so there is
the science and the sensitivity and are a mismatch for the Trump team right now, although they make sense. Right. So let's talk about Trump then, since, you know, we're talking about the big things shaping the environment in the moment. And obviously Donald Trump is the other one in any number of ways. You know, you talked a little bit about, you know, I mean, I think we've kind of moved into this, but how do you read that as a, you know, as a campaign guy?
Yeah.
You know, Darren, I mean, because obviously, you know, Trump looms very large, and he'll loom, I think, for most Republicans in Texas in a more or less positive way in the primaries, given the way that, you know, Donald Trump got involved in the legislative process and legislative races with endorsements and all of this.
Yeah.
But in the longer term, I'm wondering, like, what your expectation is here. Because to me, there's a tension between what we would think of as the usual pattern And then there's this, well, but Donald Trump has a way of sometimes breaking those patterns, sometimes not. He didn't in 2018. But what are we looking at now? So I'm wondering how you put that all together, given your campaign focus.
Sure. I think you start with the basics. And the basics are in October 2025 in the state of Texas, Donald Trump is at 42% approved, 51% disapproved. Now, what's that for, you know, context? Let me, you know, kind of do what Josh did. Let's go back to October 2017.
Yeah.
Right, after he was elected the first time. He was at 45% approved and 50% disapproved. Now, so those numbers aren't terribly distinct.
Right.
You know, they're actually margin of error type differences. I tend to think he is a tad lower, even though, you know, the statistician in me says, like, these are basically the same results.
Yeah.
But,
you know, they're moving in one direction.
Right. Right. That context was he got off to a tough start in his presidency.
In 2017.
You know, he was pilloried in the press. You know, the Democrats were all over him and his cabinet. He didn't really kind of have effective policy responses in place. There were a few things, you know, the tax cut and et cetera. But, you know, this time around, he's basically came out of the gates flying, doing exactly what he wanted to do. And you know, you could—
Republican Congress.
Right, Republican Congress and passed a lot of things he wanted. He was checked sometimes, you know, by not having supermajority in the Senate, sometimes by the courts. But he's—
Not much.
Yeah, he's down a tad from where he was. Now, the broader question, Jim, is I think a really interesting one. I'll make a big point and have you guys either laugh at it or riff on it. You know, I think the single most interesting question right now in American politics, both in these off-year elections and in the 2026 midterms, is do Trump voters, do MAGA supporters show up and vote in elections where Trump is not on the ballot? Because what you've seen in 2025 that we saw in 2017 is the Democrats are fired up. They will walk across broken glass to vote against Donald Trump or anybody associated—
Directly or indirectly.
Yeah.
Or anybody associated with him is right.
And in 2018, Republican turnout wasn't particularly impressive, but in 2020, it was. In 2022, it was kind of mediocre. And in these off-year special elections, for instance, MAGA voters don't seem to show up.
Yeah.
So we'll see in New Jersey— You know, we'll see in a couple other places, but to me, that's the question. It's interesting because it turns the turnout question on its head. Usually we talk about, because of the Democratic coalition, does the Democratic coalition show up? That question is so obsolete, I cannot, you know, well, Democrats show up, do Republicans show
up? Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think the reinforcing trend to that, to what you're asking, is the Democratic turnout in these lower turnout elections, it seems to be, as the parties have shifted in who they're appealing to, and if Democrats are now relying more on these sort of educated and seemingly more engaged voters, you seem to be able to turn them out in these special elections. Does that apply to midterm elections? And does that reinforce this trend of Trump's sort of the periphery of the Republican Party, the MAGA sort of Trump full universe can't show up?
Yeah.
I do think that's a huge question. And I've been bringing that
sort
up.
Sort of the outer band of—
Yeah. I mean, because I think it's one of those, I mean, even if you, you know, that has sort of been one of the defining features of, I think, both as a pollster and a campaigns guy, that like the Trump, you know, era in terms of when he's on the ballot and when he's not, and how different, what a difference that makes in terms of the Republican turnout.
Right. And I,
levels.
I mean, I'm co-author on a book called The Turnout Myth that says, you know, the central thesis is the notion that, you know, non-voters are predominantly Democratic or Republican. They're predominantly independent and unengaged and less interested.
Right.
And so this notion that high turnout elections have helped would help the Democrat in the past is part of the myth that I'm talking about. But it's interesting now that the coalitions have shifted. And that these blue-collar, kind of less affluent voters tend to favor Trump and the Republicans. You know, Blue Rose Research, a Democratic firm, did a really interesting analysis of the 2024 election where they said if you'd had full turnout, 100% turnout, Trump would have won by more.
Yeah.
And I think that's a
turn.
Yeah, it is a turn. And I'm still suspicious of the notion there's a systematic dynamic, dynamic to turnout.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And there's also questions about the durability of all, you know,
right,
all of
right.
This,
but,
right.
But But you set that broader kind of theoretical question aside, and you just ask yourself, who's least likely to turn out right now? And the Republicans, you know, they're kind of fat and happy. They've got their president, they've got their Congress, and
I think of it as like, you know, who's least likely to turn out? Peripheral Republicans.
I think it's a good. I think that's a good way of putting it.
There's a lot of ways to pull peripheral Democrats in right now. There's a lot of messaging that Democrats can use with independents who are pretty overtly unhappy with a lot of the things that are going on. And they're always unhappy. I mean, just say that out loud. They don't like whoever's in power. That's part of why they're independent. But that means, you know, but that's an opportunity, right, for Democrats. Yeah. I mean,
allow me to allow another countervailing factor, though. And I don't think we can know right now.
Absolutely.
But, you know, but I would also say that one thing that is different right now, I think a little bit, and I'd have to look at the trend, and I don't have it right in front of me. Josh might have it. But Democrats have an internal enthusiasm problem right now.
100%.
I mean, you look at Democratic approval, you know, approval of the party or favorability. It's a favorability rating of the party. And the Democrats are looking not very good right now.
Yeah, let me hit this real quick and you can talk about it, right? So when we ask, you know, do you have a favorable, we're doing this pretty regularly right now. Partially, I mean, just to be honest, I mean, this sort of thing that Darren's talking about here, we're kind of interested in sort of changing views of the parties. So we've been asking a lot pretty regularly on the polling whether people have a favorable or unfavorable view of both the Democratic and Republican Party. Overall, in the most recent poll, 38% of voters had a favorable view of the Republican Party, 51% had an unfavorable view, 31% had a favorable view of the Democratic Party, 54% had an unfavorable view. So again, 38 favorable for Republicans, 31 for Democrats, 51 unfavorable for Republicans, 54 for Democrats. Real quick, just to make sense of that, because you may say, why are they all underwater? Well, look, it makes a ton of sense because one, nobody from the other party is going to have a favorable view, or almost nobody, and independents don't have a favorable view. So you're going to have probably a majority of people. So really here, what we're kind of looking at is some extent, you know, the extent of it. But the more important point, I think, in all of this is to say, when we say, well, what about Republicans' view of the Republican Party? 80% have a favorable view. What about Democrats' view of the Democratic Party? 69% have a favorable view.
Yeah.
And so if you actually look at the difference of where the parties stand, going back to that October 2017, and it's actually in this case, it's February 2018 was when we asked the party favorability question. The Republicans look almost exactly the same, statistically, basically unchanged.
And again, it could move given this Trump mobilization dynamic. But I mean, when you look at the gap between 80 and 69% in terms of those party favorability numbers, that's pretty big.
Well, what's interesting, I think, about it is that if you look at the difference in where the Democrats were back in 2018 and where they are now, and again, they were still underwater, but I think a huge contributor to that change, that variance, is Democrats. It's Democrats having a negative view or not having a positive view of their own party, and that's the challenge for Democrats. But it's also like, I mean, I would say, like, just as a strategist, it's a better challenge to have than like trying to, you know, persuade a bunch of people to get like to try to get to 50% or whatever. I mean, getting their partisans back into the fold should be something that's achievable.
And thinking back to the big comparison people want to make here, or Democrats for sure want to make, to 2018, you look at this data, Democratic favorability of their own, you know, of their own party was 76% or was about 75% or so in February of 2018, and Republican was 70. It was flipped.
Yeah. Look, this is going to be one of the most fascinating things to watch over the next couple of years. On the Republican side, you know, as Trump, presumably, Steve O'Bannon might disagree with this, but exits the scene, you know, this, I think conservatives are kind of relishing this fight between the nationalist populist wing of the Republican Party and the traditional conservative wing. I don't think they should relish that fight at all.
Yeah. I think that might have already
been a TKO in favor of the Trump wing of the party. On the Democratic side, it's fascinating to watch. I think, you know, and this came up, there was an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, I think, in which there was an attempt to say that the Democrats had to start focus on winning elections again, which is news in and of itself. But it's interesting because they lost so narrowly.
Doing.
Yeah. Because they lost so narrowly in 2024, there's a strand of Democratic thinking that's, you know, we don't really, it's messaging. You know, we just didn't get our points across. And then there's another strand, this kind of goes back to, you know, the late 1980s and early 1990s when the Democrats had the DLC and these other groups that said, look, it's not messaging. It's actually, we have some policy issues that need to be hashed out, the Democratic Party. There's a fight there. I tend to think that might be a TKO also. in favor of the progressives or the democratic socialists. And I actually, as someone who's kind of more moderate at heart, am not necessarily thrilled with what I see to be the likely resolution of these conflicts on both sides. Right. You know, that I think the nationalist populist wing of the Republican Party seems to be ascendant. And I think one of the things you're looking at right now in Virginia and in Jersey compared to New York City, let's say Mondami has a resounding victory in the next election cycle. Let's say that, Mickey Sherrill has a narrow victory or even loses to Cittarelli in New Jersey. I think there could be that could be taken as evidence. No, we need to have a more democratic socialist point of view to get our right. base out to vote. And seeing that play out, that's going to be the story in the next 3 or 4 years.
No disagreements.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is the dynamic going on right now. Okay, so let's move on then and talk about where the races are. Let's start by talking about the Republican primary for U.S. Senate. That's the, you know.
Wait, there's a primary?
Yeah, you may have heard.
He's part of the 76%. He's like, what?
Did have only heard like some or a little. Nothing, yeah.
Yeah. Well, can I
please
revisit the point we just made?
Yes, you may.
Texas, as we know, is at the vanguard of all of these fights. I say that not—
Can we still use the word vanguard?
I think we can.
Okay.
That may be where we're headed. You know? But the Paxton-Cornyn race has all these earmarks of the fight we're talking about in the Republican Party, right? I mean, with Ken Paxton representing the populist kind of nationalist wing of the Republican Party and John Cornyn representing the conservative wing. And when I say that it may have already been a TKO, I think you're seeing that in Cornyn's attempt to position himself in advance of this primary. Now, there's a kind of an interesting question. If Cornyn were to win, would he tack back to the center to a more kind of traditional Republican positioning? I'm not even sure that's true. But the numbers right now, we keep harping on this point. We have been watching Cornyn's ratings over the years and comparing them to the more conservative or more MAGA figures in the state of Texas and noted that he's always lagged. And
yeah, it's one of the durable themes.
Right.
You know, we're talking less about immigration, border security. We're still talking about John Cornyn's weirdo, mediocre numbers.
Right. And Josh has the numbers within party. But overall, you know, Paxton is minus 16 fave unfave. He's 28 favorable, 44 unfavorable. Cornyn's minus 22.
Yeah.
With so far as I know, none of the indictments.
You know, this is an interesting number, and I don't know if this is going to hold, but given that the whole predicate of a lot of campaign spending right now is that John Cornyn is the much better general election candidate,
right?
His numbers look kind of weird.
Yeah, and Josh has the internal numbers, but my sense is he sort of has all the negatives of a hardcore Republican with independents and Democrats, and none of the positives
with Republicans,
meaning that Republicans love him.
Yeah. Right. Let me run through these numbers and we'll come back. I mean, one of the things I want to hear your response to is to some extent, you know, how much is this primary about winning over the Republican electorate and how much is it right now about trying to get Donald Trump's endorsement and whether that's, I mean, when I think about the way that Cornyn's, you know, brand such as it is with all the complexities that we're talking about, we'll unpack a little bit more here, you know, has suffered somewhat. I mean, how much of that is because he had a different position and he's essentially moved off of it in a way, you know, it's maybe not working for him. But overall, among Republicans, you know, John Cornyn, 43% have a favorable view of him, 24% have an unfavorable view. So 43% favorable, Paxton 55%, so 12 points higher. Again, Cornyn's unfavorables among Republicans, 24, Paxton's 16, so 8 points higher. Unfavorable among strong Republicans, pretty similar, 54% have a favorable view of Cornyn, but 67% have a favorable view of Paxton, so 13 points higher. About twice as many have a negative view of Cornyn than of Paxton, so 19% versus 10. And then conservatives, similar pattern, only 40% say they have a favorable view of Paxton, of Cornyn, 26% have an unfavorable view. So one of four self-identified conservatives in Texas has an unfavorable view of John Cornyn, and that creates this, you know, I think I may have messed that up there. So did I?
20? No,
okay, good. And then for Ken Paxton, it's 19%. So, but just to say, that's also interesting. I mean, just to say, it's not like Ken Paxton is just living rent-free here. He's at about 1 in 5, you know, Cornyn's about 1 in 4 conservatives. So, I mean, I would say that this is something underlying the poll as the Republican, to your point of using those terms, because when we just say conservative, we're not talking about MAGA Republicans and center-right conservatives. We're talking about people who identify themselves as conservative. Right. And I think I am noticing in these underlying numbers, not just in this one, but throughout the poll, you know, as the Republican Party sort of is in a process of some kind of redefinition, internal fight, whatever, you are seeing conservative attitudes get a little bit less homogenous towards a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, I would add two things to that. One is that if you drill down in that and parse it even more and you look at the people who identify as extremely conservative and the people who identify as strong Republicans, the gap between Paxton and Cornyn's favorability is even higher.
Yeah.
Is even wider. So, you know, I think, you know, that piece is sort of lurking here.
Josh, not to put you on this, because we're all responsible
for
content. Do we have a MAGA supporter question?
You know, we don't. I was thinking, I mean, part of, it's an interesting question because we had a Tea Party supporter question for a number of years. You know, do you consider yourself to be part of the Tea Party movement or, you know, kind of different kinds of things? We could probably bring something in like
that. I think we need
to.
We've actually had internal discussions in some of the national polls I'm involved with about how to phrase that. And just, just to kind of lift the hood up a little bit, we've had people strongly advocating to ask the question as, are you MAGA? And my response to that is, that sounds like what people who live in Nantucket in summer on the Cape
talk about it.
Think MAGA people talk about it.
Salt life.
My preference is, you know, but the alternative to me, the more reasonable alternative would be the distinction between, do you consider yourself a supporter of the MAGA movement, right? Or, you know, do you consider yourself part of? And I actually like supporter as opposed to part. Because it's not a movement in the sense that there's dues.
Yeah, it's a movement thing. You know, what we used to do about the Tea Party was we'd ask basically, would you vote for a Republican candidate, a Tea Party candidate?
Right.
And then we would say, but regardless of that, do you think that the Tea Party movement has too much influence, too little influence, or the right amount of influence in the Republican Party?
Like
so
that,
you take
like
it
and
as
I think that's something that we'll, you know.
Yeah, we ought to play with
We probably ought to do because, you know, just again to I think these sorts of conversations the audience appreciates because if nothing else, we are self-critical.
Yeah.
You know, but we're always looking to kind of keep up with and expand to establish trend. And, and this would probably be a good question for us to add.
Are you teaching campaigns and elections this term or next term?
Next term. Yeah.
So I want to put you in the position of one of your students.
Ooh.
Okay. You're looking at these numbers. You're looking at the trend in these numbers in the Senate primary race. You're lucky enough in the Shaw campaigns and election simulation to be given the strategist role in the Cornyn campaign. What's the strategy here? Because what they're doing right now doesn't seem to be having much of an impact. Now, it's, again, early phase campaign, but I think clearly the idea was late summer with the uptick in social media spending and messaging from the Cornyn campaign and money coming from various places was to try to drive Paxton's negatives up. What do you do?
And I'll just set this just so you know, there's been no movement since the summer in these favorability ratings for either Paxton or Cornyn and among these groups.
Yeah.
So with all this money being spent so far, it's pretty static.
Right. I actually think the central thesis of the Cornyn campaign is absolutely correct. Right. That it's going to be difficult. He has been around so long to rehabilitate. And I use that advisedly because he's not unpopular. He's just he's less popular than you would think, given he's a long-standing senator with, you know, fairly considerable credibility within the Beltway, and he's certainly not taken positions that would put him at odds with his constituents in Texas. So you look at these numbers, and I think part of what Cornyn faces is the perception that he's a creature of the establishment. He's been around a long time, and so he accrues blame for a lot of the, you know, malaise that we talked about Americans are feeling. This is a standard approach in campaigns, which is it's easier to drive up your opponent's unfavorables than to increase positive affect towards you, especially if you've been around a long time.
Right.
It's why George W. Bush went negative on John Kerry in 2004. It's why Barack Obama went negative on Mitt Romney. You know, they are, as the incumbent, the defined, you know, candidates. Now, it's a little tricky because it's not like Paxton is new or people don't have fairly durable, entrenched views about Paxton.
In fact, the opposite. They probably have stronger, clearer pictures of Paxton than they do of Cornyn.
Right.
By clear, I don't mean accurate. I just mean clear.
Yeah. And so I think, and again, so if you're on the Cornyn team, you're saying, okay, we can do, think of this as a 2x2, where I can focus on issues or character, and I can go positive or negative.
I love this. This is right?
Here we go. My little 2x2.
You get an A.
Positive, negative, issues or character.
This kid's pretty smart.
I don't think on the issue content there's much daylight between these two candidates. And, you know, in terms of character, I think you could make a strong case that Cornyn's main advantage is that, you know, he's basically—
There are many,
you know,
things he's not been involved with.
Right, exactly. That's a good way to put it, Professor Henson. So—
That's the average. John Cornyn, many things he's not been involved with.
I didn't do all that stuff.
Right. But so then your choice becomes, we're going to focus on character. Do we want to tout John Cornyn's, you know, credentials?
Yeah.
Which sometimes, it's a little tough sometimes. It's a little braggy. You know, Texans will deal with a little bit of braggadocio, but not a lot.
They like their own, but not that of others.
Yeah. And on the Paxton side, you've got all sorts of targets, right? I think one of the things that they haven't done, and I wouldn't have actually probably raised this in a meeting had I been, you know, allowed into a meeting early on, and that is the explicit contrast between what Paxton is and what Cornyn is, I don't think has been made clear enough in the advertising.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, so I think the notion that, you know, let's just say I'm running against Josh, and I'm going to say, you know, well, Josh has got all sorts of ethical problems, you know, sort of professionally and personally. But to not connect that up to my, you know, to not offer a contrast. So in other words, the advertisements have been more attack than contrast. And I think that's probably been the one thing that I think is lacking. So, I don't, you know, this is Monday morning quarterbacking, but—
Right. But the sequence is, I mean, I'm sure, as I recall, I mean, the sequence is usually the other way around in terms of kind of what you teach your students.
Yeah.
Right? You go with the contrast and see how that goes, and then—
It's, you know, it's funny when I've talked to people who've been around for a long time and I sort of say, you know, because one thing about Cornyn is that if you do watch his numbers closely, once he gets into the election season, he gets through the primary, you know, his numbers usually creep up. Now, part of it is you have Republicans saying, well, this is the guy, you know, and he's, and really, again, we probably do agree on most things. So all this kind of stuff washes away. Yeah. But also, you know, when we looked at the election results and various times where Cornyn's on the ballot and other, you know, he usually outpaces most of the people that the other Republicans that he's running against, especially in a lot of competitive areas. And so one of the questions I usually ask people who follow him closely and see him, say like, well, how does that happen? And their answer is, you know, that they're, you know, it's obviously anecdotal, whatever. But what I was here, you know, look, he takes the job really seriously. Like he shows up places, he does what he's supposed to do. And this speaks to what you're saying, which is that like, you know, in some ways he's been doing the job for so long, it's almost kind of like, yeah, of course, but it's actually kind of a big difference in terms of, in some ways, the way that Paxton has approached his job, but also it speaks to something that Jim talks about all the time, which like the overall nationalization of the environment anyway, like being the guy on the ground, you know, after the tragedy and all that stuff is great, but Ken Paxton has taken the fight.
Yeah.
You know?
That fighting part is a big deal. I mean, if you know, we've talked about Cornyn's weakness.
Yeah.
This is a polling observation. If you look at his election returns,
right,
he's destroyed everybody.
Yep.
Right. He hasn't had a race like Cruz has had, mm-hmm. right, where it's you know, 6-point race. He's beaten people by double digits.
Yeah, and I mean, they're sort of pre-election game is obviously really quite good because as weak as his numbers have always been, he's never had a really a serious primary challenger I can think of in
right.
the past.
And you wonder about, you know, this is an interesting kind of question. In 2020, a lot of the Democrats were support for Joe Biden was motivated by the argument he could win. He could win. And the Democrats were so desperate to win that they went with a candidate where their hearts were probably with Sanders or other candidates. In the state of Texas, you know, one of Cornyn's main claims is that, look, I'm going to destroy whoever I run against, right? And Paxton's going to face a challenge. But does that matter? You know, does, you know, we distinguish oftentimes political science between viability, which is the sense you're going to, or the belief you're going to win the primary, versus electability, which is general election. And I think there's a sense that Paxton is viable, but not electable. Now, that's hedged in Texas because it's such a Republican state. But certainly, you know, Cornyn has the opposite problem, which is, well, you know, there's a question about whether he's viable in against a MAGA candidate in a primary, but he's clearly electable.
Well, right. I think,
but does that matter to Republican primary voters?
This is where this all kind of dovetails together, right? Which is that, you know, you've got these sort of negative macro level features that are just everywhere. You've got the possibility of someone like Ken Paxton running as a general election candidate, kind of really at the top of the ticket for Republicans with serious, serious weaknesses, which is why, you know, it seems like almost every Democrat who, you know, has a name and some kind of title has been like, I might run for Senate, right?
Yeah. I mean, a couple things I would try to tie that all together is, you know, one, just a small comment on like the Trump endorsement. I mean, one of the interesting things about this race is that, you know, you don't want Trump to endorse Paxton. And this is part of, you know, which would be the natural expectation, I think, given everything. So it's not, it's almost sort of like, I mean, I can't imagine that anybody in the Cornyn campaign, although, you know, actually this is probably not, I shouldn't go that far, but it seems to me very much more likely that Trump does not endorse than that he endorses Cornyn.
I think,
and so part of the strategy, I think, is like a, there's a fallback, right? Which is, we don't want him to endorse Paxson, but, you know, we can live with him not endorsing anybody.
Sitting it out, yeah. There's a weirdness to this contest also, and that is that Paxton's problems with the law, I actually think, make him more attractive to Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, that there's an identification there. Like, yeah, they're going after him.
Yeah, he's been
the same way
that.
they went after me.
Yeah.
And that psychology is something that I'm sure frustrates the Cornyn people. It's like, you know, we've been with you on all, you know, we've not only been with you, but done some heavy lifting.
Yeah.
He's also not going to endorse unless he sees polling that shows that he's endorsing the winner.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the thing. I mean, to your point, to keep it, as long as Cornyn can keep this race at least unclear.
And I think that's why there was, you know, all the, you know, we've talked about on the podcast and why we, you know, there's all this stirring around about whether Ronny Jackson would get in or not, because that would help that effort.
Right.
In the sense of keeping Trump out.
And we should point out, too, that if you look at the poll, we've asked all these favorability questions. And what we would encourage people to do is to, you know, look at the overall numbers and then look at the favorability within partisanship. And our preference is to do that at very early stages, rather than run trial ballot questions, which we think are, I know, very smart, and we understand that. Look, one of the reasons that people listen or read what we do is because it's you know, seen as a perforce prediction of what's going on. We get that, so we're not trying to have it both ways,
even though it's not.
Yeah, but it's not a prediction. It's you know, kind of state of the moment. And our sort of opinion is that when you're too far out, that they're actually not only not particularly meaningful, but they could potentially be misleading. And so we're a little reluctant to do that. We want, you know, we're giving everybody information on where these candidates stand, but we think it's premature to ask the primary question at this point.
Yeah, and again, we would say, you know, the number of people paying attention is going up.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think the number, you'll probably have them in front of you, Josh. When we ask, you know, how much have you heard about, you know, the Senate race is part of the U.S. Senate race in Texas is part of our battery. It's gone from, you know, I think something like 9 to 19, and I think it was 21 this time.
Yep, 21.
Right. I actually remember.
Yeah.
Look at that.
So.
Well, and you see in the, if you look at the percentage.
People are turning, but that's only 1 in 5 Texans saying, oh, right. I've heard a lot about
well,
this.
Well, and we asked, you'll notice there's a structure to all the people we asked favorabilities about. They're basically, you know, either declared or certainly going to declare
stirring pretty heavily
candidates for office.
Yeah.
And what you'll see is that at the top end, you know, if you're talking about Cornyn or Paxton or somebody like that, or Beto or Allred, you know, the recognition is in the 90s. Yeah. But if you go to the candidates who are considering runs for slightly lower level offices, at the state level, you're talking about 66% who do not know who they are.
Well, I was going to say it's even higher in a lot of cases. It's 80% plus who don't have any opinion about these people.
So to ask a ballot question about, you know, the comptroller race.
Whose name do you like more?
Right.
Well, and look, I would even say that even in the Senate race, and I was, you know, as we were talking about this, I mean, you've still got a third of Texans saying they don't have a position, you know, they're not willing to give Cornyn a rating. 28% on Paxton. So there's still, so let's, you know, so given you, let's move on to where, to the Democratic race, where we did kind of have more bubbly candidates in the Democratic side. So the Democratic race is kind of interesting. Let's start. So Colin Allred gaining any ground, Josh?
No, I mean, it was interesting. Looking back over, so we're just real quick where he's at right now. Overall, 32 favorable, 32 unfavorable. Among Democrats, 59-10. Strong Democrats, 69-7. Liberals, 69-13. And honestly, you know, I look back to kind of see where was he in October of 2024, and really he hasn't moved much. I mean, in some ways that's, you know, good and bad, right? I mean, he sort of hasn't fallen off Democrats' radar, but he hasn't done anything
not completely.
In the meantime.
People still... A lot of people still recognize his name.
No, and you know, and again, I'm just doing this because I think it's interesting. But you know, if you go back and look kind of where Beto O'Rourke was at this point in time and compare him to some of the other candidates, these candidates are in much, much stronger positions with the party than he was at the time.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, at the time in October 2017, we were asking favorability about O'Rourke. Well, let's look at Democrats right now. To your point, you know, 34% had a favorable view of O'Rourke. So 59% have a favorable view of Colin Allred. 43% have a favorable view of James Tallarico. 62%, not declared here, but sort of starting again, have a favorable view of Jasmine Crockett.
Right. I was going to kind of try to
I'm sorry.
Spring that.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
That's all right.
I'm sorry. My bad.
That's just, no, it's okay. So we've got basically the situation where you've got Allred and Tallarico, you know, you've kind of commented on Allred. With James Tallarico, I mean, that's a pretty, you know, for a guy that just declared being 43-5 among Democrats, still half don't have an attitude, but given that he's a state rep from Austin who's never run statewide, you know, I'd say, you know, that Rogan strategy did some work.
Yeah, well, I mean, just for basic comparables, and I'm not trying to make this, there's no reason to make this comparison other than the obvious reasons, but I mean, he's 10 points higher than where O'Rourke was when he got in this race, you know, so that's, I mean, just, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just, I mean, I think part of it, sometimes you just have to take our word for it as pollsters. Like, that's pretty good. You know, for a state representative, most people don't have attitudes about state representatives. They don't represent them. A lot of people don't have attitudes about their own state representatives. So to have that kind of purchase within the Democratic Party with really, I don't want to understate. Honestly, he's done a lot to gain that with his social media. He's been very, very active. And so I think that's what you're seeing here. And honestly, the media that is favorable to those messages really has pushed him for a number of years, I think, in the state in a way that's like kind of uncomfortable.
I hate this metaphor, but, you know, and I think he, you know, he settles in a lane.
Yeah.
Right. Without getting Terry Virts, we should also mention Terry Virts got in early, not getting much traction, 9% favorable, 8% unfavorable in Democrats. But then, as Josh previewed, the interesting thing is the person not in this race. I mean, you mentioned the Beto O'Rourke numbers. I think it's, he's been pretty clear, I think, that unless there's a real change of heart, he's not going to get in. Jasmine Crockett, on the other hand, has been sending a lot of trial balloons, and she's been seeing good poll numbers. She raised a ton of money in the last cycle, and she's got a higher favorability rating, albeit by only a few points within the margin, but at 62.6, she's doing better than all of these people. And I think it speaks to the conversation that we were just having, particularly your point, Darren, about, you know, where the energy is in the primary base of both parties. In this case, you know, Jasmine Crockett, known for being, you know, aggressive, combative, you know, not shy about taking the fight. Right.
I will make a statement on Jasmine Crockett, and, you know, if I'm wrong, history will judge me. She is viable and completely unelectable in the state of Texas.
Okay, good. You go ahead, Darren. Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, that's the thing that's sort of underlying these numbers.
Yeah, she thrills the Democratic base in the state of Texas, which is not even the entirety of the Democratic Party in Texas. And I think she has next to zero appeal beyond that. But what we're seeing right here is that where she is known, she is viewed very favorably.
And you know, I think goes without saying, probably, if she is to get in the race, it kind of changes, it scrambles this race in a big way.
She raises a ton of money and I think dooms the Democratic Party in the state of Texas.
Yeah, and just to put some numbers on this to make it clear, you know, as we said, a lot of these candidates, particularly like someone like Tallarico, he's got high faves among Democrats, but is largely an unknown quantity to Republicans who aren't paying attention to him. Crockett does not fit that definition. She has very high favorability among Democrats, but 58% of Republicans already have an unfavorable view of her. And she hasn't even run statewide, and she already has a majority. So that's sort of the piece here. I mean, like, a lot of minds have been made up about Jasmine Crockett, and it's challenging, probably looking ahead.
All right. So let's Darren's got to go teach class in a few minutes, so let's do a quick dealer's choice. What else in the poll we haven't talked about kind of stood out to you that you want to flag and talk about for a minute or two, Darren?
I'll go with two things, if that's okay. And I hope I'm not
stepping. Oh, look at this guy. He's going to expand.
That's right. I'm going off the board.
He's improvising. He's jamming now, man.
Exactly. The first is if the audience takes a view at the raw numbers on most important problem facing the state of Texas or most important problem nationally. The percentage of people saying partisanship, you know, political leadership,
corruption
is really striking. You know, we've been banging on the consistency throughout the years in Texas about immigration and border security at the top, the economy, and then whether it's unemployment or inflation. You know, you combine those two things, the economy broadly speaking, immigration, border security broadly speaking, those things just dominate in the state of Texas, and they also do pretty well nationally. We talked a little bit about, or at least I talked about malaise, the perception that our leaders are failing us, that our leaders are stuck, I think is pervading the sentiment in this poll.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing I take a look at as a response to that open. Well, it's not quite open in it. We offer people 500 different options, but they're choosing.
Not quite that many, but
yeah,
a lot.
I know.
And we validate them.
Second thing, real briefly, is we asked a question kind of deeper in the call, Q17, I believe, we identified earlier. Do you feel safer in your neighborhoods, in your community, than you did a year ago? And that number
it's just generally how safe
do you feel?
Yeah.
And the percentage you say they feel extremely safe has gone up since, you know, Trump and the Republicans have taken over. It's not a huge jump, but it is statistically significant. It's on the order of, you know, 7 to 10 points. It's not unusual. Those safety numbers are consistent with what we saw about 7 or 8 years ago during the Trump term. But boy, the lack of safety went up. Perception of lack of safety went up during the Biden years. That's come down again. And, you know, I think that speaks to the possibility that crime is abating as an issue. And maybe winning an issue doesn't necessarily help you politically.
Well, I mean, those two points go together, right? Which is, as you know, what's also happened is Democrats have really coalesced around this idea of political corruption, leadership being the most important issue facing the country. The share of Republicans who say immigration on the border has collapsed as essentially Trump has won the issue. And as other Republicans can't talk about it critically all the time. And so these create challenges going forward.
And we'll put a pin in it for next week to then talk about your point in conjunction with support for the military deployment to the cities. But
I'll be real quick. You know, we asked three questions about vaccines. I just want to hone in on one. There's a question we've asked a bunch of times about whether parents should or should not be required to vaccinate their children against sort of common, you know, childhood diseases, including in the STEM, we say, like measles. For example, we had a large measles outbreak here in Texas. Big deal. Going back to in 2015, 75% of Texans said that parents should be required to vaccinate their children. 14% they said they should not. Today, 65% say they should. 22% say they shouldn't. So greater than 1 in 4, 35% of Republicans, so almost 1 in 3. We have a lot of vaccines and exemptions in the state. So get ready, guys, because you know, there's no herd immunity going forward.
So I'm just going to flag, we've got a bunch of items on tariffs that we didn't really talk about. Before the podcast, we were talking about the impact of tariffs prices. I think this triangulates interesting with the, you know, the national economic perceptions and the local ones. And these numbers, they do interesting things, right? But I would say that Trump's approval ratings on trade relations has gone down. And some of the concern among Republicans about tariffs is inching up in some of the dimensions.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm just, I don't think it's a big thing. And so I'm like, aha, there's this thing happening. But those numbers are still like very, you know, we're still seeing this dynamic where I believe that there's been a little bit of erosion in Republicans' acceptance of the possibility that tariffs could be good for the economy in the long run, even as many acknowledge, it's going to raise prices, which has essentially been, or at least was, the White House argument. But I think the more these tariff arguments go on and the trade, you know, there's the Trump taco thing, there's the kind of increasingly apparent bargaining tool he uses to raise them galactically and then negotiate to lower them, which is a reasonable enough strategy. But I think while we're watching that all go on and people are reacquainting themselves with what tariffs are, and we're waiting to really see what the impact is going to be because there have been some lags that you were talking about, we were talking about earlier. I just think those tariff numbers are very interesting. So we'll wind up extrapolating on that again, I think, probably in the next podcast. So thanks to both of you taking the time and for all the work on the poll itself in this and the dozens before it. Thanks, as always, to our excellent production team in the Liberal Arts Development Studio at UT Austin. Thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you're listening on a platform, there'll be a post on our website and we'll add some of the many numbers that we've talked about. But the quickest way is probably to just go to the post the summary post we put out when we rolled out the poll yesterday on Wednesday, which has all of this and lots more. Plus, Darren is inviting you to follow along at home, links to all the documents as well. So with that, thanks for listening and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.